We are concerned about how different approaches affect our poorest, most vulnerable citizens.
A new report gives a poor grade to current state budget plans. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 14th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, King Cove residents make another plea to Congress for a road to Cold Bay.
Putting elders in a crab pot and using a crane to hoist them to the top of the dock is frightening.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska's salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
The legislature is trying to close the $4 billion budget deficit this week, but a new report says the burden of closing the gap will fall too heavily on the poorest Alaskans. If every element of Governor Bill Walker's current fiscal plan is adopted, low-income Alaskans would lose nearly 10% of their income. Middle-income residents would lose about 4%, but the top 1% of state residents would only see a 1.3% cut. That's according to a report by the nonpartisan an Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. The results would be more skewed if the state doesn't adopt an income tax. In that case, low-income residents would still lose more than 9%, middle-income residents would lose 3.5%, but the high-income Alaskans would lose less than a quarter of 1%. The Rasmussen Foundation commissioned the report. Foundation President and CEO Diane Kaplan says the report gives the legislature and the governor a chance to reflect on how their actions will affect different groups.
We are concerned about how different approaches affect our poorest, most vulnerable citizens. As our member of the legislature, as is the governor, and that's why they asked us to get this information for them.
The reason the results affect income groups in such different ways is that low-income residents rely much more on permanent fund dividends. They would see their checks cut in half by a proposal released by legislative finance committees this week. Walker also proposed a lower income tax rate than any other state in the country, 6% of the federal income tax liability. The new report found there would be a more balanced effect if the state reduced dividends by $370 and set income tax rates at 15% of residents' federal tax liability. Kaplan says the state needs a balanced approach.
There are several different approaches that are reviewed in the report. We don't endorse any one of them. We don't condemn any one of them. We say these are all good pieces of information for our elected officials to use as they come to a sound decision here before heading out of Juneau this year.
Revenue Commissioner Randall Hoffbeck says Walker's administration tried to be balanced while setting the income tax at a level that wouldn't be controversial. They ruled out a statewide property tax because there's scant information on some unorganized borough land, while a sales tax would also burden low- and middle-income residents and communities that already have their own local sales tax.
When it came right down to it, we found that the income tax was the one that really fit the governor's overall plan the best, in that the income tax is progressive. It hits the higher-income taxpayers more, and that works in conjunction with a reduction in the size of the permanent fund dividend.
If being uncontroversial was the goal, it's not clear Governor Walker succeeded. Republican legislative leaders have resisted any income tax. Eagle River Republican Representative Dan Sadler asked Hoffbeck how Alaskans could be assured that once an income tax is introduced, the rate wouldn't be raised. The commissioner responded that Alaska has a history of eliminating income tax when state oil revenue went higher. Alaska is the only state in the country without either an income tax or a statewide sales tax. The House Finance Committee has scheduled public testimony on Walker's income tax proposal and the proposed permanent fund plan for this evening. House Bill 126, aimed at strengthening the dated Alaska Code of Military Justice, passed out of the Senate State Affairs Committee this morning and now moves on to the Senate Judiciary Committee. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
It's almost like you guys have been frozen in time or something.
That's Senator Lisa McGuire, an Anchorage Republican, speaking at a Senate State Affairs Committee hearing on HB 126, which would update the Alaska Military Code of Justice for the first time since 1955.
It's odd to me that there's this living, breathing Alaska statute that hasn't been updated. It doesn't really reflect on anything the Guard's doing.
An investigation 2 years ago by the National Guard Bureau found no real recourse for cracking down on perpetrators after allegations of sexual assault and harassment within the Alaska National Guard were brought to light. Colonel Chris Weaver is the staff judge advocate to the Adjutant General of the Alaska National Guard.
They reported, in summary, that the current ability or authority of commanders to impose discipline in the ranks was without teeth, or as I paraphrase, toothless.
The goal of HB 126 is to add those teeth. It's a point generally agreed upon by lawmakers and military officials alike. What's not universally agreed upon is how new authority should be employed. The final amendment to the bill discussed in the Senate State Affairs Committee illustrates the gap between the state and the Guard. HB 126's initial language would not have allowed a Guard member to decline non-judicial punishments, or NJPs. These are issued to reprimand minor offenses and carry less severe penalties. The amendment, which the Guard is against, would allow a Guard member to decline NJP in favor of a full court-martial. Colonel Weaver says it raises the stakes for the soldier.
Now they're exposed to potentially 6 months of confinement in a special court-martial, or up to a year of confinement for a general court-martial, and they risk either a punitive discharge, which is either a bad conduct discharge or a dishonorable discharge, depending on what court hears that case.
Despite the potential for more severe penalties, Weaver says a soldier might still choose to roll the dice because they know a court-martial is expensive, and they are gambling that the Guard won't want to spend the resources on a full proceeding for a minor infraction, so it could result in the charges being dismissed altogether. If a service member accepts NJP, the resulting punishment could be as minor as a dock in pay. While Senator McGuire says she understands the Guard's point of view, she says it comes down to an issue of fairness and objectivity.
I can see where it would affect morale positively if that person was truly guilty of what they were doing and corrective action were taken. So I see the positive side you're talking about. And the negative would be that they're being unfairly targeted, that there's a bias against them, that there's a misunderstanding, or that they're truly innocent.
The amendment was ultimately adopted by the committee, which means service members would be allowed to decline NJP in favor of choosing a court-martial. HB 126 was passed without objection to the Senate Judiciary Committee for further discussion. If the bill is not passed before the legislature adjourns, lawmakers will need to reintroduce it next session. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Walt Monaghan is once again the commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. Governor Bill Walker announced the appointment in a press release this morning. Monaghan will replace outgoing Commissioner Gary Folger, who is retiring at the end of May. Monaghan was chief of the Anchorage Police Department from 2001 until 2006. He previously served as commissioner of the Department of Public Safety from 2006 through 2008, when he was ousted by Governor Sarah Palin as a result of the Troopergate scandal. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the fears of immigrants who lack proper documents.
We're talking about people who are terrified about making their existence known here.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott joined residents of King Cove in Washington, D.C. this morning to make another plea for a road between King Cove and the all-weather airport in Cold Bay. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Mallott likens King Cove's effort to other public land use controversies, in which he says federal policymakers put concern for wildlife habitat and the national interest ahead of the needs of rural Alaskans.
In order to preserve something that is called the greater good, our lives are minimized, marginalized, and in many ways consciously determined to be unimportant to the point where we become faceless.
Mallott spoke at a hearing called by Senator Lisa Murkowski. Alaska's congressional delegation has tried since the 1990s to get a road for King Cove. They say residents need a way out in bad weather, especially during medical emergencies. But 11 miles of the road would have to be built in the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge.
This refuge is one of the most vital and extraordinary wildlife and wilderness areas in the world, and it must remain that way for all Americans to enjoy.
Nicole Whittington Evans, Alaska Director for the Wilderness Society, testified against the road. She says it would pass through a strip of land that's an important wildlife corridor for bear, wolves, and caribou. On either side of that land corridor are two lagoons that Whittington Evans calls the heart of the refuge.
Most of the world's population of Pacific black brant and emperor geese and a significant portion of the threatened Steller's eider population depend on Eisenbeck's habitat.
Interior Secretary Sally Jewell ruled out a road in 2013. She says she's trying to find an alternative. Aleutians East Borough Mayor Stanley Mack says other alternatives make no sense, given King Cove's often harsh weather and the realities of boat travel.
Strapping an injured patient in a gurney and hoisting them up from the dock of the up to the dock on a boat, which can be as much as 25 feet, is always a scary situation. This is basically what we have to do. Or putting elders in a crab pot and using a crane to hoist them to the top of the dock is frightening.
Speaking to reporters after the hearing, Alaska Congressman Don Young said the secretary is valuing geese over people. Young says he might just go to King Cove and build the road himself.
So I can drive that DA cat right down that road right where it's been surveyed and then see what they're going to do. Now, if they arrest me, that's better yet.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's not giving up. She didn't say what her next move will be, but she noted that Jewell won't be Interior Secretary much longer. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A bill with big implications for alcohol and marijuana has sailed out of the House Judiciary Committee without opposition. SB 165, sponsored by Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki, deals primarily with reforming the rules around alcohol consumption for minors and adults younger than 21. The bill changes the minor consuming alcohol violation under Title IV, making it a $500 penalty similar to a parking ticket. That fee can be lowered if a person completes a treatment program within a few months, which supporters of the bill say is a more effective way of dealing with youth substance abuse. The rule change would also keep a young person's name from appearing on the state's CourtView website. House Judiciary Chair Gabrielle Ledoux, Republican from Anchorage, calls it a big improvement.
As someone who once upon a time had teenage children, I always was kind of perplexed by some of the insanity in our alcohol regulations relating to minors, and this fixes a lot.
Many Title IV laws haven't been updated since 1980. Another part of the legislation clears a roadblock currently faced by residents hoping to start cannabis businesses across the state. It authorizes the Department of Public Safety to run criminal background checks on applicants, which are currently under review by the state's Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. SB 165 now moves on to the Rules Committee. Proponents are optimistic it will pass this session. Matt sues Port McKenzie is feeling the sting of the state's budget acts. The borough's plans to upgrade the nation's northernmost deepwater port has been stymied by setbacks. Most recently, state funds to complete a rail spur connecting the port to the main line in Houston have been put on hold due to the state's budget trouble. Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer has more.
A bid to adopt a Port McKenzie master plan into Matanuska Sioux Sitna Borough Code failed to gain enough borough assembly votes for approval last week. Port Director Mark Van Dongen told the assembly that the proposal was only the third update to the port plan in the past 16 years. Van Dongen urged haste in approving the bid because of a plan to expand the port by adding additional tidelands.
There's a potential for a company to come in and put a dock in those tidelands. We have about 2 square miles of tidal right now. We want to add about another half a square mile.
Van Dongen's appeal went unheeded, and the port plan issue was postponed until June. Port McKenzie has rarely earned enough money to support itself. The borough supports port operations through an annual line item in the borough's area-wide fund budget, something that does not go unnoticed by borough property taxpayers. Michelle Church, a former borough assembly member, says one problem has been no link with its counterpart in Anchorage.
Until you get coordination between the two port areas, you are continuing just to dump money down this rabbit hole. This port plan is just nothing but dreams, and you're talking about exporting coal. I mean, do you guys listen to NPR? Because, nobody's using it.
Church spoke at last week's Borough Assembly regular meeting. For this fiscal year, the borough appropriated $980,000 for port operations, according to Van Dongen. And in an emergency move last December, the Matanuska Sioux Sitna Borough Assembly approved an additional $2.5 million loan from its land management fund to pay for urgent repairs to the port's barge dock. But the borough's area-wide fund is supported by property taxpayers, and critics of borough spending like Patty Rosnell told the assembly that it is misleading to tell taxpayers that the port's enterprise fund will repay the cost of the port's repairs.
Port revenues do not make enough to pay port costs every year. And we know the enterprise fund as such has failed, and in fact, that it is the general fund, Fund 100, residential property taxes that pay for the port.
Assembly member Dan Mayfield, who supported the port loan, told the body that the emergency repairs started in December have been fairly successful, but that winter ice prevented repairs on one important structural component of the ailing barge dock. He says the repairs must go forward to protect the borough's investment in the port so that in future, its success could take the burden off taxpayers. Port McKenzie offers the northernmost deep draft dock in the United States, 60 feet deep at low tide, Van Dongen says. He says its design makes it capable of exporting any commodity, gravel, wood chips, coal, or any other mineral, even LNG. But until the rail spur is completed, the port is not likely to see long-term financial viability. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
A jackup rig contracted by Fury Operating Alaska is currently docked in the port of Homer, and the city is earning $1,000 per day in dockage fees. The port provided similar services to another rig in 2012, but in the process, a set of rules the state created to protect Ketchumak Bay were broken. KBBI's Quinton Chandler has more.
The state legislature passed a law back in 1974 to designate Ketchumak Bay Critical Habitat Area. The Homer Port and Harbor was inside of the Critical Habitat Area and according to the plan written in 1993, no drill rigs were allowed to be stored inside the port. Homer Port and Harbor Director Brian Hawkins says the plan wasn't compatible with port and harbor operations.
The idea that what we do here is more vessels, and that technically we were in violation of that just doing our normal operations, would tell you that we need to address that.
Hawkins says the conflict was made very clear when the Endeavor Spirit of Independence jackup rig was brought into the port by Buccaneer Energy in 2012.
We realized that when the rig came here that they had to put the legs down because it was a safety issue. They would have damaged the rig and or damaged our dock.
Jackup rigs come equipped with legs that can stand the platform up on the ocean floor when it is drilling. When the legs aren't in use, they stretch up into the air from the rig's surface like massive towers. Hawkins says under U.S. Coast Guard rules, a drill rig is considered a vessel when its legs are up. When the legs are down, the rig is considered a drilling unit again. According to Hawkins, when the Endeavor came into the port, it was supposed to just stay for a few days. But things came up, and the Endeavor ended up staying for months. One day, there was a forecast of gale force winds, and a choice had to be made.
There's just no way that they can moor like a normal vessel, you know, to the facility, because there's just too much sail area with those big legs sticking up in the air.
The Endeavor's crew decided the safest option for humans and wildlife alike was to stabilize the rig by lowering its legs onto the seafloor. But that put Buccaneer in violation of the management plan. Hawkins says an environmental impact study showed there was no damage to habitat, but the city decided it needed the state to remove the port and harbor from the critical habitat area. Senator Peter Michicki of Soldotna sponsored a bill to do just that in 2014, and the bill passed. Hawkins says that's why it's legal for the Randolph Yost jackup rig to stand on its legs in the port right now. Bob Shavelson, executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper, thinks the bill went too far. He'd rather have just seen the management plan for the critical habitat area revised.
I think you have to recognize certain provisions for industrial activities around our industrial hub there and build those in, but also build in some protection. So there's some sideboards there. It shouldn't just be nilly-willy management there.
Shavelson acknowledges the economic impact drill rigs spark when they come into the port can be beneficial. But he says it's also important to pay attention to the impact rigs can have on marine life. Hawkins says even though the port and harbor aren't included in the critical habitat area anymore, everyone who uses them still has to follow regulations created to protect the environment. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chandler.
According to the Pew Charitable Trusts, about 52,000 Alaskans were born outside of the United States. The 2012 study estimates that a quarter of them are here without authorization, some because they came as children and had no way to get documents. The Alaska Institute for Justice is highlighting some of their stories and the contributions immigrants are making to the community through their event, Justice Beyond Borders. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman, learn more.
Maxim Mamatov moved to Alaska from the Soviet Union in the early 1990s when he was just 13 years old. He says everything seemed so different.
A lot of things that you guys have here, I did not have as a kid. They existed, but they were not as widely spread. Computers, you know, VCRs, cars.
Mamatov says life here was better, so his family decided to stay. He says a few years after arriving, his parents applied for permanent residency, but it took more than 7 years for the application to be processed. In that time, he graduated from West High School and the University of Alaska Anchorage, and he became too old to be part of his parents' application. But by this point, Alaska was his home.
When I step off a flight in Anchorage, I feel like I'm home. You know, you get that, I don't know, it's just a weird feeling that you feel like you arrived to where it feels right.
So he got a job as an auditor and was given a work visa. And that's where it gets tricky. He had the visa, but he had to travel outside of the United States to a consulate to get it fully approved. He decided to go to Russia to visit the woman who is now his wife. When he went to get his final approval,
the consulate denied it, basically telling me that I was in the U.S. illegally during my previous stay.
Mamontov wasn't allowed to return to Alaska. Robin Bronin with the Alaska Institute for Justice says she doesn't know the specifics of Mamontov's case, but stories like his are pretty common because of 20-year-old immigration laws.
If you are in the United States without immigration documents for more than a year and you leave, even if it's to visit your loved one, and you try to re-enter, you will be barred for 10 years.
She says this applies to people who came as children without a choice, too. Though Pew estimates there are about 15,000 unauthorized immigrants in Alaska, Bronin says it's hard to really know.
Because we're talking about people who are terrified about making their existence known here.
When Mamontov graduated from college, even though he didn't have long-term documents, he wasn't worried about people knowing he was in the United States. He thought that with his work visa in place, leaving and coming back wouldn't be a problem. But he was stuck in Russia for 7 years trying to fight his case.
People are saying taxes are complicated. Immigration is, multiply that by 10.
He considered different options for coming back. Friends suggested he marry a U.S. citizen. But he didn't want to break any laws. During his 7-year wait in Russia, he got married, worked, bought property, had a child. He considered giving up the fight.
I'm not going to argue. I'm not going to put up a fight anymore because I'm getting old to a point where I have to figure out what to do for the rest of my life. So I cannot be in this suspense for another 7 years or 5 years. So I think this is it.
Mamontov decided to try one last time to return to Alaska. His employer applied for another work visa. He found the right lawyer to argue the case. And in September, he returned to Anchorage. He says it was a hard decision to leave his wife and 6-month-old son. This is his home. His family may soon follow. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
The Justice Beyond Borders storytelling event is tomorrow night in Anchorage. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Josh Edge, Ellen Lockyer, Zachariah Hughes, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and Quentin Chandler in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive educational adventure designed to support your personal and professional goals. Through generous APU scholarship packages and the new APU Promise Tuition Grant Program, APU is a sound educational investment in your future. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
The weeks are counting down until the first salmon return home to Alaska rivers and streams. Alaska's people live lives that are deeply connected to salmon. Alaska's economy and families are fueled by these relationships. Learn more about Alaska's salmon at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.